But probably the weirdest thing is that playtesting often isn't fun. Because we sit there and I say we set aside 45 minutes, but in that 45 minutes, sort of 20 to 25 minutes of that is actual gameplay, and 20 to 25 minutes of that is making notes, discussing how things are meant to work, particularly early on in the games.
Howdy friends, Craig here. I have a chance to sit down with another Insider Insight episode, this time with Lewis Clark from TT Combat. They're probably best known for their games Carnevale, Drop Fleet Commander, Drop Zone Commander, and Rumble Slam. Not to mention their amazing MDF terrain. It's really neat to learn the process that Lewis and his team go through to create that amazing terrain, from sketches to design to the final laser cuts. We also learn kind of the insider insight on design, both for miniature games like Carnevale, but also for larger games like the Drop Fleet Commander and stuff that is built for competitive play like Drop Zone Commander. I'll warn you ahead of time, it is going to be very difficult to listen to this episode and not go to their website and explore some of these games. There's such a wide variety. You've got the insights after listening to how they were made and the ideas behind them. And that Carnevale book is probably one of the prettiest rule books I've ever seen. So sit back and learn a little bit from behind the curtain on how to make terrain and how to design games. Enjoy.
Playing a tabletop strategy game allows you to unplug and test your skills against friends. Every week, Third Floor Wars delivers useful strategies, discussions, battle reports, and reviews to tabletop games like Malifaux. If you want to get better at the games you already play, or discover the games other people are playing, you are in the right place. Craig and Ray welcome you to the Third Floor and the Tabletop Talk broadcast.
Craig here on the Third Floor for another Insider Insights episode of Tabletop Talk. Now, today I'm picking the brain of Lewis Clark. He's the head of design over at TT Combat. It's a company I'm sure that many of you have heard of. In his 4 years at TT Combat, he worked on the graphic designs of MDF Scenery, collaborated with David Lewis and Gav Thorpe on game designs, and you can see his fingerprints on games like Rumble Slam, Carnival, and a new edition of Drop Zone Commander, all games we're going to cover and talk about today. So, Lewis, welcome to the Third Floor.
Thanks very much, Craig. Thanks for having me.
So I'd be curious, you know, for most new guests, I like to find out, you know, how you became a gamer. So there was a day that you knew nothing about tabletop gaming whatsoever, and then you found out about it. So how did you discover tabletop gaming?
That day was a long time ago. So it's probably 24 years ago. I was 10 years old. My next door neighbor brought back some Warhammer. I think he brought back some Plague Marines, the old plastic Plague Marines from an independent store just in a couple of cities away. This is before the day when we even knew that Games Workshop existed. From there I was pretty much hooked for all the rest of the time after that. I've played a lot of 40k over the years, a lot of Fantasy Battles, Mordheim, Blood Bowl, you name it, any Games Workshop games I played. I've dabbled a little bit into Infinity and X-Wing and Drop Fleet Commander, actually, interestingly enough, before I worked for TT Combat as well.
Oh, no kidding. So you were playing Drop Fleet even before you came on?
Yeah, my gaming group sort of got stuck in with the Kickstarter and I joined them a little bit. It was at the time I'd moved from my regular gaming group in Bristol down to Cornwall. So it was sort of, dipped my toe in and I was getting ready to get sort of really stuck in before I joined up with TT Combat.
That's interesting. So that'll be the next step, right? So you, as a kid, you discover tabletop gaming, you come into the ecosystem the way that most people do through Games Workshop. Then it sounds like you start exploring outside of Games Workshop and looking at games outside of Games Workshop. When did TT Combat come on the radar?
I made a move to Cornwall. Previously from that, I was at university, and previously from that, I did my, of course, classic stint working for Games Workshop for a while. Of course, working in the retail. After I moved to Cornwall, me and my now wife, we worked in restaurants and things for a little while after university. We took a trip to America for 3 months, toured around, and then after we came back, we tried to find jobs in different places, and we settled on the fact that we probably wouldn't be able to get jobs in Cornwall, because I don't know how much you know about the UK, Craig, but it's not the busiest place in the world down here. sort of fresh from uni, we wanted to do something, with our degrees and sort of committed to going somewhere else. And in that time, sort of job searching, I found out about TT Combat and went on the website and I was like, these are great. They had some really good MDF kits, which I ordered and started putting together at home. And then literally about a couple of days later, after I got them in the mail, I saw that they had a job advertisement. So I sent this really geeky email to them saying, "Hi, I've just bought some of your kits. Can I please have a job?" Which worked, apparently.
At least got you the interview, it sounds like.
Yeah. So they hired me in actually to work on the laser cutters, like just actually doing the MDF laser cutting. And when I got there on the first day, they came up to me and said, Have you got a graphic design degree? And I was like, yes, and a few, several years experience. I can do these programs. And they went, great, we've got this game Rumble Slam, and we've hit a wall with it where none of us know how to do the sort of production stuff for it. I was like, oh, okay. Well, let me come up from the lasers, get someone to cover me. And yeah, they sort of snowballed from there.
So that's interesting. So it was, even though you had the background, your way in was basically sounds like manual labor, right? Doing machine work.
Much. Which is something that even now today we still do with every new person that comes into the design department. Particularly, I make sure that they've got background in the laser cutting, background in resin and assembly, everything there, so that everyone knows how the company works.
Yeah, I can imagine that's a big deal. Now, when you came on with TT Combat, obviously they were working on Rumble Slam. Mm-hmm. Obviously they had Terrain, which is what I'm the most familiar with, and what I associate with TT Combat. And I own an obscene amount of your Terrain. What other games were in your under your roof at that point? Was it just Rumble Slam or?
Well, so at that point at TT Combat, they'd been to Kickstarter with Rumble Slam, and it was in development but not ready to go. And then they'd bought Carnivale and another game called Home Raiders from a company called Vesperon Games. And they sat on that for a little while. I came in, and a lot of the sculpts had been remade at that point, but it was still very, very early stages. It was very much they were treading water with it, trying to find out what they wanted to do.
I've been calling it Carnivale. Should it be Carnivale?
I mean, don't let me tell you how to say Italian words.
You know better than I do.
We've been told it's Carnivale, but Carnivale. Oh,
okay.
Is fine.
Well, that's easy enough. So you start work on Rumble Slam. And had you been exposed to Carnivale at that point, or
not at all? No, okay. Very little. I mean, at that time there were. Well, there are three, four of us in the design room in total. So anything that came in from sculptors, we all saw. But other than that, there really wasn't that much work being done on it at that point. It was all sort of full steam ahead to get Rumble Slam ready and done.
Right, right. Very interesting. Well, guys, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back from this break, I want to talk to Lewis about kind of the process of making MDF Terrain. I know a lot of you listeners out there use MDF Terrain. You've seen the boards here on the third floor and seen several of the 3D the Terrain. My introduction to Carnivale, how I found out about them is I started buying the Terrain for Malifaux, and then realized, wow, there's a game, and I kept hearing good stuff about it. So we'll talk about Terrain. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app.
Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Howdy friends, Greg here. Nothing makes Malifaux easier than having the right tools. Here at the Third Floor, we love all the licensed Malifaux goodies from Custom Meeple. Not only are they helping support this podcast, they sell custom-made weird licensed tokens and terrain. They sell it all. Crew boxes, terrain, markers, tokens, and even a 3x3 full Malifaux board. Custom Meeple sells a complete M3E token set covering every marker and token you need to play. Custom Meeple are the source for the official accessories for Malifaux. Everything is designed by hand and authorized by Weird Games. Check them out at CustomMeeple.com, that's with one M, or follow the link in the show notes. Up your Malifaux game and be sure to tell them Craig from the Third Floor sent you. If you use the promo code Third Floor Friend, all one word, THIRDFLOORFRIEND, you'll get a 5% discount and help support the podcast. It's valid on everything except retail products and playmats.
So I've bought MDF terrain from several different companies. Some companies I've bought more terrain from and other companies I would never buy another kit from them. Because not only does, you know, the final product need to look good, but MDF, I've seen it designed to be built in a good way and in a terrible way. And not only in the process of building it being unnecessarily difficult, but once built, how sturdy it ends up being. And Lewis, part of the reason that I have bought several more kits from you after buying my first kit is I really enjoy how you guys lay everything out and how sturdy things are when they're built. But I want to learn about or get some insight on the process itself. So a building does not exist, right? Nobody's ever drawn it. Where does the initial idea for a kit come from?
It really depends on what the kit is for, to be honest. So for a lot of the Streets of Venice range, which you said you use for Malifaux, which is good. A lot of those I designed myself. But then we've got sci-fi gothic, we've got industrial hive, things for 40K, things for Necromunda, things for Drop Zone Commander. They all come from different sorts of places. So I think the very first step is, what does a game need?
Okay.
And what scenery is most useful for that game? What are we missing that we don't have already? So I'll probably focus on Streets of Venice because that's what I'm most familiar with. So for Streets of Venice, it's designed for Carnivale primarily, which means that it needs to be able to be climbable, needs to be able to be sturdy, needs to have flat roofs for walking on the top of, and it needs to facilitate ways of moving around the board. So we start off with an idea of what we want. So a piece that I've recently designed, we had an issue where a lot of the games, if someone wasn't very good at climbing, they struggled to get up to the rooftops. So I've designed a few pieces which have sort of staircases that go all the way up. So we see something that we need in the game and, yeah, try and figure out a way to do that. So that's probably the first thing, is making sure that everything is deliberately designed for a game.
So it sounds like functionality might be kind of the first thing. So the need, the game need, and then that it's literally rules functional.
Yeah, absolutely. Because we can make the most beautiful things in the world, but if you can't play on them, then they're pointless, essentially, for what we do. So yeah, that's the first thing. Make sure everything's functional in whatever way that is. So we start off with that and then decide what it should look like. And that's a lot down to the designers. And we've got four people at the moment in the design team that design MDF scenery primarily. I dip in every now and again, whenever I feel like it. And we tend to sort of discuss the brief, discuss what needs to happen. They'll go away, sketch some things up, and then come back and say, look, these are some ideas, and I'll say yes, yes, no, yes, no, whatever's best, whatever's most useful, and whatever looks good. And from there, they go in and start the actual design process. And there's a lot of freedom for what people want to be doing. So our briefs tend to be, we need a new set for Industrial Hive. And so I'll go and say, we need something that uses loads of pipeways, and that's it. So as many things you can with pipeways, and someone will come back with a sort of basic sketch of how the pipes should go together. And they say, okay, well, we need 5-6 different kits for that. So knock yourself out.
Right. Now, I would be curious to know from the artist's perspective, when you're concepting out, is that literally sketch pad and pencils and you just start, you know, sketching from there? Or is that being done digitally?
A little bit of both. It depends on who's doing it.
Okay.
I tend to start off digitally, and we use SketchUp quite a lot. Mm-hmm. I'll go in there and just block out shapes. And it's literally just cubes and cubes and circles and whatever it needs to be to sort of get out the basics. But some of our other designers, we got a designer called Ben. He's a very good artist, and he'll sit down with his sketch pad and come back after half an hour and have a whole page of sort of sketches. It depends on what everyone's more comfortable with. Some people have a great idea straight off and go straight into it. It really depends on what everyone is, how everyone works best.
So for look and feel, is a lot of it just coming from the back of the brain, or are you getting on Google Images, or, you know, I'd be curious to know aesthetically, once you've got the functionality piece together, you've sketched out maybe some rough designs, but things like the detail, the overall feel and look, where do you guys tend to find those?
It's so different depending on what we're designing. So, recently, Scott has been designing some industrial stuff. And so we both made up, because we're working remotely at the moment, we made up sort of a huge sort of Pinterest board of just random sort of industrial sort of looking designs. So power stations and sort of abandoned places, things like that. But then for like when I'm designing Streets of Venice range, I've got a bookmark of Google Earth pinpointed in Venice. So I just go around the streets and see some of the things for what I want to be making. It really depends on what people are making.
So it seems obvious to me for the games that TT Combat produces, right? So making terrain for Dropship Commander, for Cannavale, all of that makes a ton of sense for me. But you guys have terrain that's outside of your game's corral. So when do you decide to make a terrain that's not game specific for one of your games? When does that decision making happen?
That's most of the time, to be honest. Pretty much the whole time. We know that Games Workshop games are the most popular. So we try to make it so that at least 50% of our designs are for 40K, for fantasy, for Necromunda or whatever. And then from there onwards, we sort of divide them up for the rest of them. So we try to make it so it's about 50% Games Workshop, 25% for our games, and 25% for other games. Depending on what's coming out at the time. So we've had the team going through with some, we call it cyber terrain, but let's be honest, it's Necron terrain. for the new edition of 40K, they've been sort of all hands on deck doing, new Necron terrain. Because that's what's, really big at the moment. One of the great things about designing MDF is that it's not got a huge lead time on it. It's one designer who makes the product, takes it down to the lasers, it gets cut, and they put it together. So we can work quite quickly, depending on what's going on in the outside world. For miniature design, it takes a fair amount longer. We can be quite reactionary with it. So we tend to work in quite a large buffer of time. So we've got designs that we've sort of previewed sort of 6 months ago, which we're now getting to the point where we can release. But then there's other things where we go, there's been a surprise announcement, so let's make something for that and release it next week.
So are you mass producing? So once, let's say design is done, everybody signed off on it, this is a new product for us. Do you then just use in-house lasers and just produce a shipload of them, or is it on demand, or how does that work from a pipeline perspective?
One of the most interesting things I think about TT Combat is that all of our production is done in-house.
That's nice.
Not just the MDF, but the resin as well. Everything.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Everything's in Cornwall. We've got a big old warehouse, and you can go outside and you'll walk through people assembling things, people pouring resin, people cutting things on lasers. Well, our design room is directly above the laser room, so you can hear when everyone goes on lunch because it goes quiet all of a sudden. we tend to mass produce everything at the moment because of COVID restrictions. We've been socially distancing everyone in the department. There's been, the laser's been up and running, but because we have fewer people working, it's been a bit more reactionary. The shelves are getting a little bit low, but we're getting there at the moment. We've got 18 laser cutters in the warehouse, and we're expecting another 12 laser cutters in the next 2 weeks from today, from data recording.
Wow. No kidding. Yeah. So, well, that's a sign of good things, especially with the lockdowns. It's good to hear that that there's growth there.
Yeah.
So you came on to TT Combat, had never designed an MDF kit before, right? Mm-hmm. So what surprised you? What was what was something you hadn't thought would be a challenge that ended up being a big challenge in that process?
Do you know, the strangest, and this is going to sound like I'm not very smart at all, but the hardest thing about designing MDF is it's 2D.
And interesting.
It's an obvious thing that it is 2D, but every now and again, even now, several years on, you get sometimes you forget that it's 2D. You'll design a piece that's, you know, sort of loops around and it's circular and goes up a certain amount, and you're like, oh no, hang on, I can't do that because everything has to be flat. Everything has to draw right at 90 degrees. So that takes a real, real big amount of getting used to. And it seems like a weird thing because that's the whole deal with MDF. But yeah, you're just so used to designing things in 3D and making sure they all work, you forget that actually everything has to attach to everything else. 90 degrees can only go one direction.
So in the design process, I'm trying to figure out whether you work forwards or backwards. So the end product is going to be a bunch of boards that are that have been laser cut, right? And then those boards will have to be assembled into the final product. As you're going through and designing to get to that final product, are you thinking about layout and building and, you know, how it's all going to work together as you go through that process, or do you end up with the final product and work backwards?
It's a bit of both. So when I first started, the entire process was done in 2D. There was no 3D design at all, which I came in with my interview, brought my little laptop and said, look, I've made this on SketchUp. What do you think? And they were like, oh, we don't do it in 3D. And I was like, well, wait, sorry, how do you do it? Said, oh, well, we design it in 2D, we get it cut, and we see if it goes together. And I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. I don't have a laser cutter at home, so I can't test that. So for me, it was obvious to do in 3D. And over the last sort of few years, we've transitioned into making things 3D first, and then we sort of go through a process of flattening it all down. As you develop more your own style, and as you're with the company for longer and doing more of the work, you get more of an idea of what will flatten better and what will take up more space. So everything goes on the same size sheet. We have a sprue size, which everything has to fit on there. Occasionally, we can go a little bit bigger if we've got baseboards and things, but we tend to keep everything that size. It fits in boxes better, it posts better, which means that we can cut the prices down for the shipping, which is ideal. But yeah, you're sometimes a little bit restricted with that. So sometimes someone will design something, I'll be like, that's really cool, but it's too big for a sheet. But if you cut 3 inches off it, then it'll be perfect.
Right.
So yeah, we do have sort of upper limits of what you can do.
Interesting. For final production then, so can you just walk me through maybe one of the most recent designs that you did for Streets of Venice? How does it all finish off? So I get it. I do have a sense of how it starts. I get a sense of inspirations that you use. You put it together in Sketch 3D. You flatten it out. What are the last steps before it shows up on the website?
So after you've got it 3D, you flatten it down. You've got your sprues. You send the sprues down to lasers and they get cut. They come up and we do our sort of first test cut. And fingers crossed, the first test cut works and goes together fine, but 99 times out of 100, it doesn't, and you need to go back and tweak a little bit. After you've done your first round of tweaks, we tend to have crits all the time. Everybody in the department is able to chime in whenever they want. Everyone's in quite close proximity. At the moment, we're a bit further away from each other, but all in the same office, so you can say from the other side of the room, hey, that doesn't fit together properly. but yeah, everyone's completely open to all suggestions. We all know that you work better as a team, you work better with input from other people. And there's so many times when I'll have something I think, yes, this is brilliant, and someone will come along and go, will a 40 mil base fit in there? And I'm like, oh no it won't. Okay, I'll go back and I'll make it a little bit bigger so a 40 mil base will fit. Brilliant. So after we've done the crits, it tends to go back to lasers. It comes back up. Our first round of production cuts, we go in with a marker pen and sort of scribble on things and say, you move this way, get rid of this, add some damage there. And the second round will come up, and hopefully on the second round it's correct. It will go together and that's great. It goes up to Joe and Joe does the photographs for us, and then it goes up on the website. We tend to have a very final laser review where the laser department also get a say in how things go together. So if something's going to them and they've realized that actually this is probably going to cause a fire because there's too many lines on this little bit, if something's a bit too close, then there's a chance it's going to set on fire, or they cut something and this bit always falls out, they get a say because we got to make their jobs as easy as possible. It's not fun working down the lasers with that noise all the time.
Making sure
it's easy for them is the best way. So yeah, they get a say, I get a say, and then it goes to sort of get photographed in production.
Yeah, and I would imagine, I mean, really what the laser people are also doing is doing some quality control for the end customer too, right?
Yeah,
because,
you
know, I've had kits not from you guys show up and there's four pieces missing from it, you know, because of that wasn't thought about in that process. So a silly step, but I'd be curious, do you have somebody that does the instructions or is that done by the designer or how do the instructions get made?
It's done by the designer.
Okay.
And it's always a bit of a grudge that no one ever wants to do the instructions because they finished their kit and they know how it goes together, but no, tough. You have to do it. Previously, when everything was designed in 2D, it was then taken into Blender in 3D to make the instructions. And Blender isn't the best program for that. Blender's a fantastic tool and very powerful for certain things, but it's not good for making instructions. So that's what I think.
I would imagine SketchUp is a much better program. Yeah.
So there's a lot of animosity towards making instructions before, but with SketchUp, it's super easy. You get your 3D final piece and you tend to sort of pull one piece away, color it in, see where it goes, and then move on to the next step. But a product isn't finished until instructions are done and up on the website. That's cool.
All right. So last question before we take a break. What is a design that got rejected by you that you still kind of go, oh, man, I really wish we could have figured that out or didn't get rejected? Is there a design somewhere that we never saw that you still have a soft spot for?
Oh, there's loads. Yeah, there are quite a few. There's some that have been up on the website and then gone taken down again, actually, which is actually a really weird situation, but tends to happen sometimes when it goes up and it turns out that it just takes so long to cut and there's so many different elements to it that it's never gonna work. There's a piece that I've created in the last sort of year, which hasn't seen the light of day yet, which is, so for reference, a sprue is about a sheet of A4, which is for American size, just bigger than paper, than letter size. And there's a kit that I've made, which is 500 sprues.
Whoa!
It's quite big, and I can't say exactly what it is because it's still a bit of a secret, and I'm still hoping, fingers crossed, that it might see the light of day at some point. But this is one that I've been sat at home in my evenings going, yeah, this is going to be cool.
Oh boy, you've piqued my interest. That sounds amazing. 500 boards.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, I'm going to have to think about that a little bit. Now, the other part of me is like, who the hell is going to put that together?
Yeah, that's the hard part.
Oh, and not to mention the shipping, right?
That's funny. Lonely.
Yeah, exactly. You can get it in pickup, or we're going to send it to you in 7 different packages. That's funny. All right, guys. What we're going to do, we're going to take a break. When we get back from this break, I want to talk about a game that I have heard about. I have visually seen it, so it's not like I didn't know it existed, but I really don't know a whole much about it, and that's Rumble Slam. So we're going to come back and we're going to talk a little bit about Rumble Slam. We'll be right back. Howdy friends, Craig here. You deserve a new playmat. Here on the third floor, we use Mats by Mars. They are scratch resistant, waterproof, wet erase marker compatible, almost free of glare, and lighter than neoprene. Mats by Mars gives you over 40 designs to choose from. You pick a mat, pick a design, and then you pick an overlay, like one for Marvel Crisis Protocol, Star Wars Legion, or even Malifaux 3rd Edition. Those overlays will really speed up your deployment and make the placement of objective markers so easy. Use our promotion code in the show notes to get a 10% discount on your first order. In the notes of your order, you can even request the third floor logo on your mat for free. That makes the best mat in the business even a little better. So get some new mats. Save yourself some money and help support the show. Go to matsbymars.com. All the details are in the show notes, including the discount code. So like I said, Rumble Slam is a game I've heard of before, and I wanted, of the three games we're going to talk about from TT Combat, it was the first one I wanted to cover because it's the one I knew the least about. So Lewis, where did the concept, well, first of all, for those that don't know what Rumble Slam is, what is the elevator pitch? This is Rumble Slam.
Rumble Slam, the game of fantasy wrestling. I mean, it's as simple as that. It really is. It's orcs, dwarves, trolls, even some humans every now and again, ogres and things in a wrestling ring fighting it out and doing wrestling things. It's exactly what that sounds like.
That's cool. And it's not like Greek wrestling. We're talking about professional wrestling. Oh, no, right?
We're talking about WWF 90s style wrestling.
That's great.
As brightly colored as you possibly can. Yeah.
Where did the original idea get born?
So this is one that the big boss of TT Combat, Louis, he came up with it. And it was as simple as, what about a game of fantasy wrestling? I think it starts off very much as what about Blood Bowl, but wrestling? And there's a lot of comparisons you can draw thematically with that. But if as we get into it, I think you'll probably see that it's completely different.
So the boss man says, hey, let's make pro wrestling Blood Bowl, right? We'll take the concept of a fantasy sports game that we've seen a million times. We're going to apply it to professional wrestling. Was there any concept in his head about how it would work mechanically or anything like that? Or is it just, hey, here's go make this?
It was a little bit of both. It was very much, this is my idea, go and make my idea. But there's a few sort of guidelines to it from what I know about from the early days. And these are things that have come up more and more in recent years, is that it has to be small and it has to be quick.
Okay.
So it was very much designed as a game that you can play in the pub or that you can play at the end of a gaming evening. So if you're waiting for your friends to finish a bigger game and you've got sort of half an hour, 45 minutes, Rumble Slam's the game to do it. You need sort of half a dozen models maximum, and it'll take, between half an hour and 45 minutes to play.
That's nice.
It's a 1-foot by 1-foot mat. It's a tiny little thing. You can get, we do MDF rings that you can actually, get all the ropes and everything. And you will want to do that because there's nothing better than bouncing your models off the ropes across the ring. But it was designed to be small and fast.
So when you look at it from a mechanical sense, is there certain highlights? So things that people that would find interesting about the game?
Well, if you like wrestling, you'll like Rumble Slam, basically.
Okay.
This is how we sell it at shows. If you have even a passing interest in wrestling and know what a turnbuckle is and know what it looks like when you do a clothesline bouncing off the ropes, you can do all of that stuff in the game. It's exactly what you'd expect it to be. There's a few sort of... We try to make sure there are some key rules in every game to make sure that's sort of the hook that brings people in. With Rumble Slam, there's a lot of freedom of movement to get stuck in quickly. There's none of this sort of set things up in the first turn and then everything kicks off in the second turn or third turn onwards. From the first turn, you can get stuck in and, start punching people. And then there's also the crowd pleasers. Crowd pleasers are this sort of unique mechanic to the game. Every single wrestler has a unique crowd pleaser, and they can use the power of the crowd to sort of boost themselves up. So they can gain benefits in their stats, or they can perform extra special moves, that sort of thing. And the crowd are the third player or sort of fifth player, depending on how many people you've got in the ring. They're the sort of extra player in the game. And everything sort of revolves around them. There's a special dice called the crowd dice, and it has cheer, boo, and blank. Generally you're hoping for cheers, unless you're a heel, in which case you're hoping for boos. No one hopes that the crowd ignores them. If the crowd ignores you, that's the worst that can happen. And there are so many different things that sort of go off the crowd dice to see how the game progresses. Because you're not just playing the game and you're not just wrestling, it's sports entertainment. You need to make sure that you're appealing to the crowd as well.
Yeah, that adds a whole other element to it, and it's super thematic. Mm-hmm. So back when there were shows, let's say that you're at a show, Lewis, and some random gal walks into the booth and says, hey, what's this? And points to Rumble Slam. You do your demo of it, and they buy it. They walk away. I'd be curious to know what you have seen to be the hook. So when someone walks out of that booth and has bought Rumble Slam, what have you noticed to be what hooks them?
So I think probably the biggest thing that gets people involved and gets people thinking, oh, okay, this is a game that I can actually play, is that not only is it small, but you can play with every single miniature in the range. We have factions. Each of our wrestlers belongs to a certain casino, and there's loads of different casinos, from Kaiser's Palace, which is sort of Greek themed, and there's humans and halflings and things, and then you've got things like Rolling Bones, which is a cross between skeletons wearing mankinis and orcs and goblins and things. It gets a bit weird. So every wrestler belongs to a casino, but you can mix and match as much as you like. If you stay within the same casino, you get a sponsorship bonus. You could be sponsored sponsored by like Orca Cola, who you drink Orca Cola and you get a bit fighty, or you can be sponsored by Eagle Airways, and once per match the Eagles will swoop in and move your models around, that sort of thing.
Nice.
But if you want to, you can just pick any model that you want, and there's rookies in the game, so you can get like Orcs and Goblins sort of basics, but then there's Superstars as well, who are the named characters. And for reference, it's about 50-50 of the model range, so we've got around 50-60 rookies and about 50-60 Superstars. The Superstars are like your special characters. They're a bit more powerful, but they cost more in, well, it's points, but we call it dosh, how much dosh it costs to actually recruit your effort.
I don't think I realized that you had that many miniatures out there. That's a lot of minis. Mm-hmm. Wow. So, Lewis, how about for you? So, obviously, Rumble Slam was kind of being formed, and it was sounded like it was about mid-form when you came on. Though you played a lot of games, you weren't a game designer by trade at that point. How involved now do you get in the actual design of the game, or are you pretty much, you know, kind of the art director piece of this?
So for our design team, we've got about four or five people that do the MDF design, and we've got about the same number doing game design. But all of us have other jobs at the same time within the company. So I do graphic design within the company, but also writing and community posts and all that sort of stuff. And we've got a web designer who also does sort of game testing, all of that. Mm-hmm. So everybody gets a say, but I lead the direction of where the game's going to go. So I say, I want this casino next. It's going to be, we're going to have a south of the border themed casino,
right,
which has come out recently. And it's going to have skeletons that are sort of covered in Day of the Dead paint.
Nice.
Yeah. We're going to have things like that. And we're going to have a pinata that explodes when you punch it, stuff like that. And then I'll pass it off to someone if they've got particular ideas of how things work. But everybody sort of pitches in. So a couple of weeks ago, I was playtesting Rumble Slam. We've got new things coming out. So I sat there with Chris, our web designer, and we sort of set aside 45 minutes at the end of the day to do a bit of playtesting. Mm-hmm. Everybody has something to do. I sort of lead the overall design of them.
Got it. And what is, if you had to think of one thing that, if we went back in time, Lewis, before you started getting involved at games at that level, right? So before you came on to TT Combat, what is something that you would have told old Lewis that he wouldn't believe about game design? So you're like, you know, this is something that a listener does not realize about the process you just talked about.
Probably that you've got to play it just so much.
Yeah.
Just so, so much. And everybody knows that playtesting happens and you've got to play as much as you can. But probably the weirdest thing is that playtesting often isn't fun.
Because
we sit there and I say we set aside 45 minutes, but in that 45 minutes, sort of 20 to 25 minutes of that is actual gameplay, and 20 to 25 minutes of that is making notes, discussing how things are meant to work, particularly early on in the games, early on in development of the rules. We had when we'll get onto it in a bit, but when we were playtesting Carnivale, we had two of the team who we said that we've got this starter intro book of scenarios, and we need this to be perfect. So you've got 2 weeks where you do nothing else but play Carnivale, and they came out of afterwards and they're like, "Can we do anything else? Can we go to the lasers? Can we pour resin for a bit? Just any other work?"
Literally the last thing I want to do is look at a miniature right now.
one of the things that's great about TT working for TT Combat is we've got four main games. So if you do get a little bit like drawn out on one of them, you can switch to something else. And there are very few times, very few days when I'm at work when I've not got three different games on the go at any one time.
Yeah. And, you know, talking to other game designers, Lewis, we think about playtesting, we think about, you know, the beta testing, right? And from my understanding, that's a very late stage in the process, that there's just so much work and so much play that happens long before you get to the, we're going to have outside playtesters, you know, go into it. And the one thing that I have heard more than once, and I'd be curious to know your thoughts on this, when a gamer hears playtesting, especially a competitive gamer, what they hear is balance, right? Mm-hmm. So as a player, lots of players say, you know, playtesting is about balancing the game. But I've heard from several designers that I've had on the show, Lewis, that that's really not the first thing that's thought of, that there's so many other considerations, from playability, from fun is the biggest one that I hear mm-hmm. about, is that you're playtesting to see if people are having fun and enjoying themselves. Where does balance fit into your priority list as a designer?
It's a really tricky one to get balance right, generally speaking. And balance is different depending on what game it is. So in Rumble Slam, making a new superstar, to be balanced, every single superstar has to be OP.
Yes.
That's sort of the rules in Rumble Slam. Yep. If everything, we do the sort of Incredibles route of it, that if everyone's super, no one is. So Rumble Slam very much fits into that. But then a game like Drop Zone Commander, which is much more focused on competitive play, balance is much more important. But it comes, balance comes after thematics for us, generally. Right. So something has to feel right. And if it feels right, then we make it balanced. A really good example is a couple of weeks ago, we did a new balance pass for Drop Zone Commander. And we've got a tank which has a ridiculously massive chain gun on top, like a twin chain gun, which looks like it does so much damage. But the first pass of it we did gave it sort of two dice to roll. And it was balanced. It worked all right, but it didn't feel right.
Right.
So we went back and said, okay, let's make this gun so much worse, but give it 8 shots instead. And now it's, we like it. It's a bit, you look at it and you go, oh, well, that's unbalanced. But when you actually come to play it, we think it's a lot better for that.
Yep. No, that's very cool. Well, speaking of Drop Zone Commander, I want to talk about that. So let's take a quick break. When we get back from this break, we're going to talk about a game that I've got a short list of games everybody I talk to that plays it says it's a great game. Everybody should be playing it, but everybody's not playing it. And Armada is one of them. You heard me talk about Armada on the show as one of the best games nobody's playing. And Drop Zone Commander is another one that falls into that thing. So I'm anxious to talk about it. We'll be right back.
DZ Leergard here, creator of the M3E Crew Builder app. And I'm a patron of Third Floor Wars because supporting great content creators like them is one of the best ways to help grow this game. So to join me and the other floor heads, go to patreon.com and search for Third Floor Wars, and we will see you there.
What is it worth to you to get this podcast on a weekly basis? Is it worth $1 a month? $5 a month? $20 a month? If you'd like to help support the work that we're doing here on Third Floor Wars, please go by our Patreon. We're at patreon.com/thirdfloorwars. There you can pledge at any level, any dollar amount. Whatever you give us will help us put out quality content on a regular basis and hopefully make tabletop gaming a little bit better for you every week. Hey, need to give a special shout out to some of our newest patrons. A big thanks goes out to Bob Fletcher, Old Doc Fulton, Joseph Pye, Loke Walmo, Nicholas Prinzing, Dareth8952, Sven Hoffman, Mike Schmidt, and Peter DeArmas. The only reason we're able to put out content on a regular basis is because of you guys and gals. Thanks a ton. So from my understanding, Lewis, Drop Zone Commander is one of the games that TT Combat acquired, right? It was put out originally by another company and TT Combat bought it.
Yeah, that's right. It was Drop Zone Commander and Drop Fleet Commander were put out by Hawk War Games, who did a great job with the games, but they overextended themselves when they did Drop Fleet Commander. They did a very, very successful Kickstarter, which was a lot more successful than they thought it would be. Overextended themselves. They were a much smaller company than us. They did very, very good work for the amount of people they had. They basically weren't able to keep the business running. So we stepped in and, well, we'd like to say saved. took over the IP. We've still got the head designer, Dave Lewis, on staff. And he works Drop Zone and Drop Fleet nonstop, 100% of the time. Now it's sort of, we're giving it a new lease of life.
So first thing that's unique about it is the scale, right? It's not your typical 28 millimeter scale. It's a smaller scale, correct?
Yeah, Drop Zone is 10 millimeter scale. So it's close to old Epic. And it was created at a time when Epic had gone and Games Workshop wasn't focused on specialist games. So they stepped in and brought Drop Zone Commander to the fore. It's not a scale that's seen widely now. Like, mm-hmm. We've got Titanicus nowadays, which sort of does a little bit the same, but it's a much sort of smaller, more compact game than Drop Zone. Drop Zone is about armies. It's about larger armies taken to the battle. And it's a completely different game than what Epic used to be as well. It's all about fast-paced mobility, making sure that you've got enough transports to get things around.
Yeah, and now we talk about Drop Zone and Drop Fleet. For people not familiar, what is the difference between the two?
So they're set in the same universe, which is set 2060 in the future. And humanity's gone out to space, settled some worlds, and alien race comes in and takes over Earth, and takes over their sort of original settlements, and they're pushed out to the fringes. And then we skip 200 years into the future after that to the actual modern day of Drop Zone, which sees humanity coming back, fighting a war against the aliens. Drop Zone is 10 millimeters to scale. It's all about tanks and infantry and walkers and things on the ground. And then Drop Fleet pans out to orbit level, and it's all about the spaceships dropping those ships down. And you can play them simultaneously, but it'll be, we sort of say it's one turn of Drop Fleet Commander is an entire game of Drop Zone.
Oh, wow.
That's sort of the time scale sort of difference for it. That we've got rules published, in which case you can do campaigns, like branching narrative campaigns with alternating game types. But yeah, they're very different games. It's very much a mass battle game for Drop Zone, and Drop Fleet is more of a sort of standard fleet game.
Got it. Now, you mentioned in the previous segment that this has got a more of a competitive target audience than, say, Rumble Slam, which sounds to have more of a kickback, beer and pretzels type thing. What is it about the Drop Zones that make them geared for competitive play?
Well, they were originally designed back in the day when Games Workshop didn't care about competitive play at all. I listened recently to your podcast with Jamie talking about that, yeah. Which is great. I was like, yeah, that's exactly the situation. They were very much geared towards that gap in the market. And they've both got really tight rule systems to them that really help that. Rumble Slam is very much, like I say, it's beer and pretzels. It's hot dogs and big pointy foam fingers, I think is what it really is. Drop Zone and Drop Fleet are very much more focused on competitive gameplay. But within that, it's the setting, I think, that people keep going back for, because it's a completely unique sci-fi setting. It's very hard sci-fi. It's not that sort of 40K style. Oh, it just works. And anything you don't understand is space magic. We don't really have that. We've got some very sort of hard and fast rules within our sci-fi, and everything is quite specific into how it works. And one of the great things about it is that it's quite logistical, in that troops go in ABCs, ABCs go in dropships, and then if you pan out to sort of Drop Fleet Commander, you know, the dropships go in Bulklanders, and Bulklanders go into strike carriers, and yeah, you can see the whole war process going on.
That's cool. Yeah, I've heard from several people that the rule set is very tight, and that the original rule set was good, but it's only gotten better. So hats off to you guys for being able to kind of keep that momentum going. And it is one of those games that turns heads too, because of the difference in the scale. The multi levels that the game works at, I think, is very, very interesting. So it's on my long list of games that I need to at some point give a try. Yes, I know. Speaking of which, really the game that made me want to have Lewis come on the show is Carnivale, because it's the one that I'm the most familiar with. Lewis was good enough to send me the rule book, which I have ingested, and I'm really anxious to talk about this game. So we'll be right back.
Howdy, friend. Craig here. Is this episode making you realize you need to buy some models? Gadzooks Gaming is my favorite online retailer because of their large selection, killer prices, and great customer service. Don't you hate buying an entire crew box when you only need one model? Gadzooks sells crew box models individually and saves you a ton of money. They even have free shipping to the U.S. and Canada if you spend $100 or more. Swing by GadzooksGaming.com and make sure you tell them Craig from the Third Floor sent you. All the details are in the show notes.
So it was one of our listeners, one of my listeners reached out to me and said, hey, Craig, you know, what do you know about this game? And I was talking to him about it. And I said, you know, I've heard it's a really great game. And I've seen some of the miniatures for it. The miniatures are really unique and pretty. And I told him I was loved the terrain for it. And he's the one that connected Lewis and I. And Lewis was kind enough to have one the rule book sent to me for Carnivale. And I'm a little jaded. I have seen many a rule book. I have bought more than I want to admit, and have flipped through several rule books. And I gotta tell you, it has been a while since I have been wowed by the look of a book. In this day and age, to get a book that was just has this wow factor. So, and obviously it's a little hard on a podcast, but, if you go to the TT Combat website and take a look at it, the artwork is so thematic. I love the fact, that you've got actual miniatures, painted terrain all throughout the book. That's what draws us to play miniatures, are those moments where you have painted miniatures and painted terrain, and it really captures, but it's accented with it. Layout wise, just gorgeous. So even not even getting into the rule set, I think anybody who loves miniatures, just pick up the rule book, because the rule book is for somebody who loves miniatures. Even if you don't end up, you know, playing the game, I think it's worth it. But let's talk about the game. So the first thing, Lewis, is much like Drop Fleet, this is one that you guys acquired. So can you kind of give me how that happened?
Yeah, so this was from a company called Vesperon Games. And Vesperon hit a point where they had this game and they'd put... a guy called David Esbury. David Esbury had put a lot of his own time into it. He was still working another job, and it just started to take off. But he ended up at a point where he wasn't able personally to see that happen. He had a lot of different things going on, and yeah, wasn't able to do what Carnivale needed. So he got into talks with TT Combat, and TT Combat bought the range from him. So they bought the IP, and also all the miniatures and all of the molds. And the molds have been run at this point for a few years and had seen better days, let's be honest. It was old metal molds as well. And the metal miniatures are great and can get some fantastic detail, but if you don't look after the molds, then they tend to go downhill very quickly. Mm-hmm. So yeah, TT Combat ended up being faced with a bit of a dilemma as to what to do with the game, because it had quite a small but very rabid fan base for it. The people that had seen it loved it, but it mm-hmm. wasn't appealing to a greater audience, and the miniatures were needed something doing to them to carry them on. So he made this decision to take the game back to Kickstarter and basically reboot it. So the setting is the same. The factions are all there, including additional factions that were added and didn't have all their models. And all of the models got remade from scratch. So between Rumbleslam and Carnivale, this is what started TT Combat producing everything in-house. They sort of looked at what the best way is to do it, whether they could outsource, whether they could 3D print everything. And it ended up being resin production was the best way to do it. So we ended up setting up an entire resin production department based on these two games, which is great. Really, really, really amazing for having something in-house, particularly in the UK and particularly for us in Cornwall.
I'm sure.
Unique. There's nothing like this for sort of 500 miles.
Well, and it's kind of that Games Workshop model, right, where you now control the entire supply chain. And you know, you want to talk about Kickstarters, you know, the ones that are struggling because they've had to outsource so much of it. But that's also a huge risk. So, I mean, hats off to you guys for working out, because that's a big die to roll. Yeah. We could not be talking right now because of that decision. But obviously it worked out, and there's tremendous benefits from it. So it's a skirmish level game. Aesthetically, it's got a little bit kind of that look and feel of Malifaux, because it's kind of, you know, the it's not medieval times, but it's got a little bit of a fantasy feel to it. It's definitely thematic. So the streets of Venice, kind of that look and feel of it. But there's a lot of unique things in it from a not only from a premise standpoint, but from a mechanic standpoint. And I want to talk about movement first, because that's the part that really just grab me out of the gate. So can you talk to me about, you know, how movement works in the game?
Yeah, it's a 3D game, and Venice is the setting, and Venice is everything about the game. If you know anything about Venice, that is what the game is grounded on. And we say it's really cheesy, but we say that when we went to Kickstarter, we sort of scrapped off most of the rules and built everything from the canal up.
Nice.
To make something new. Yeah, cheesy, but it makes sense. And movement is sort of the core mechanic of the game. Everything else is interesting and fun, but it's all about moving throughout Venice, and it's all about we kind of make sure there's sort of three distinct levels when you're playing the game. Most miniatures games, you tend to just stick with one level, or occasionally you'll go up on sort of a balcony, right, or something. And there's a very good reason for that we'll get into. It's hard to make 3D game. It's really, really hard. So we have three levels. We have water, we have ground, and we have rooftops. And different characters perform better at different things, but you can do everything you'd expect to on those different levels. And it was important to us to make sure that being in the canal is worthwhile or detrimental, depending on who you are, and being on rooftops is worthwhile or detrimental. Because there are a lot of games where you can get into very specific situations which benefit you, but the benefit is nowhere near enough to make it worthwhile going out of your way to do it. But yeah, the game's all about acrobatic movement, parkour within Venice. It's tight streets, it's climbing up, it's running along walls, it's jumping across rooftops, diving into the canal, in rowing gondolas. You can do all of that sort of stuff. And that was sort of key to making sure the game felt right.
Well, and I think in many ways, for me at least, reading the rules, because I haven't played yet, but I read the rules, really defined the game for me, and really is what kind of set it apart and brought some new things to it. I'd be interested, the version that you acquired versus the version of the rules that got kickstarted and where you are now, how much changed? So how different is the game from kind of its original concept that he made versus what you guys are producing now?
So the biggest change that we had, and this is the design ethos that we took through from the start to the final product, was that the original game was great and thematic, but you spent most of your game reading the book.
Got it.
There were about 40 odd actions that you could take, and every single action had a pass, like a sort of pass state, fail state, critical state, and fumble state. And it's very much, it was designed as sort of a bridge between role-playing games and tabletop games. Mm-hmm. But everything you did had a very specific action reaction. And we wanted to make sure that when we were playing the game, we were playing against our opponent, not playing against the rules. So we took from 40 odd actions, we took it down to about a dozen different actions.
Yeah.
There were 15 different actions just for moving. And now I think we have two, three, maybe.
Yeah.
So we made sure that everything makes sense with what it is. And it's a way that when you're playing the game, you can think, oh, I want to run on that wall. How does that work? I can probably figure that out without having to look it up. And then you'll go back and look it up and go, yeah, I was right. Yeah, that makes sense. And we sort of built the rules around that sort of idea that everything should be obvious and everything should be what you expect it to be as an extension of the rule. This comes from an extension of playing so many demos of different games over the years. And Carnivale came after we'd been demoing Rumbleslam for 2 years at that point. And we knew sort of, I've done hundreds and hundreds of demos in my time with the company. I've probably played more games of Carnivale than anyone else. But only with the same six models.
That's funny.
Yeah.
You're really good with them.
Oh, no, I'm not. Oh, no. We sort of saw how people reacted to certain rules and which things trip people up. And I'm sure you know, every time you play a new game, you get things that you're like, well, sorry, I don't understand how that might make sense.
Yep.
And occasionally you'll get that and then it'll click and you go, oh, no, I get it. And we try to make sure that all the rules in Carnivale follow that format. And so you'll see multiples of the same sort of thing over and over, even in different contexts. So for jumping, for example, you roll a certain amount of dice and you get 2 inches of jump plus a number that you rolled. And then for drowning someone, you get 2 points of damage plus the total of damage of dice that you rolled. For grappling someone, you throw them 2 inches plus that you rolled. And we tried to make sure that everything works together so that, like I say, even if you are doing something you're not completely comfortable with the rules for, you can guess what it is and you'll 9 times out of 10 be right.
Right. Right. Because there's a consistent, a consistency throughout it, right? And a familiarity that comes from that.
Yeah.
So that's got to be a huge challenge, Lewis, from a design perspective, because you have a spectrum, right? Mm-hmm. So you have tight but simplified rules. And an example of that is Marvel Crisis Protocol. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at that game at all, but it is what those guys did there is they said, okay, look, this is not a simulation. Right. What we've got is a whole bunch of superheroes, and we're going to make rules that you don't have to spend all your day in the rule book with. And the game is going to move along, but there's some abstractions, right? So there's going to be some times when you look at the models and you go, well, he really shouldn't be able to see him, but we've simplified line of sight. So it's going to. So they walked away from that simulation and just say, we're going to keep things very tight and streamlined. Then you go to the other side of the spectrum and you find like Infinity, which Infinity is very much a rules heavy, simulation type things. There's silhouettes and, you know, just the whole thing. And it takes, you know, 5 pages of rules to figure out how to move from this point to that point. And it sounds like the original version of Carnival was leaning more towards that Infinity side, right? With all of that, you know, multiple options and, you know, spending so time with the rules. And it sounds like you wanted to move it more towards the streamlining. Was that a burn it all down process? Did you guys just say, look, we need to start over? Or was it just a cutting process? So how did you get from the rules you inherited to where they are now?
It was definitely a cutting process. Like we started off with what was good about it, cut out all the stuff that didn't matter and kept the things that were core to the rules. I think probably the most important rule in there, the golden rule, it's the first thing that you read when you start reading the rule book, is that if it's cool, let your opponent do it. And this is different. This is going to be very different for you, Craig, from Malifaux. Like it's very much a narrative game. You can play Carnivale competitively, but whilst you're playing competitively, like you want to win, but you need to make sure that everybody in the game is having fun and everybody can do the things that they think are cool. Literally the first rule in there is if it's cool, let your opponent do it, because next turn you'll want to do something cool that they should let you do. So we start off with that.
Right. And what sounds like one of the goals, and this is I love this as a goal, is you're trying to create those moments, right? Moments that stick with you. And I've had this conversation several times with designers where nobody remembers you rolling 4 sixes 6 months ago, but somebody will remember that time where you grabbed the guy, you ran across the canal, threw him into the wall, and this happened and that happened. And it's just this epic cinematic moment that really miniatures and role-playing games are the only two things that really give you those moments where you have an entire movie sequence that goes through your head. So it sounds like that's one of the goals for Carnivale, is to create that type of thing.
Yeah, it's about telling a story with your opponent. There's when we do demos for the game, there are two moments in the game that will 9 times out of 10 will sell it. If I've done my job properly,
right.
We'll sell the game. And the first one is the Capo di Cina, who's the Assassin's Creed kind of looking guy with the swords and the hood. He jumps off the rooftop and kills someone from above. And when you do that, when you attack someone from above, you get -5 to their armor save. And usually 5 is a good armor save. So generally speaking, you get no protection roll at all. So you do that and your opponent goes, okay, that was horrible. I'm like, yeah, sorry, I didn't tell you about that in advance, but yeah. And the second bit is when sort of one of the lesser Ugdrews, which are the sort of Lovecraftian fish monsters. And you go, do you want to get your own back on that guy? You go, yeah, I do. Okay, throw him in the canal and drown him. They go, what, you can drown people in the canal? I'm like, yeah, of course you can.
That's cool.
This is a different game. This is not the game that you expect a sort of small-scale skirmish game to be. It's very much, it is Venice the game. It really is.
So, any good game, and I don't care if it's a board game, I don't care if it's one of those, you know, simple streamlined games I talked about, or one of the simulation RPG type games I'm talking about, one of the biggest things that defines a game is decision making, right? We want to be making decisions. We want those decisions to matter. In your head, when you think about it for players, what are key points in the game where decisions do matter? What's the difference between winning and losing as far as player agency is concerned?
more often than not, the difference between winning and losing is using the movement of your force properly. It's making sure that you're in the right place at the right time. And with Carnival, you play on typically a 3-foot by 3-foot board, so it's not that big. And a lot of the scenarios in the book play on 2-foot by 2-foot, which is even smaller. Yeah. Like it's not, you can't escape very far. But within that, you can get from one side of the board to the other in an activation if you move properly. So you can walk along the ground, or you can run along the ground, and you move your sort of movement in inches, and that's fine. Or you can jump from the ground onto a balcony, use that to get an extra jump across onto the roof, run across there, and so land on the floor from the other side. Like it is exactly as you'd expect it to be. Like the cooler that it is, the more rewarding it is, not just in telling your story, but in actually winning the game as well. We always say, whenever someone says, "Oh, can you do this?" say, yeah, you can do that. And remember, like fortune favors the bold. In Carnival. Yeah. So long as if you try really hard, there's a chance that every single person is going to be able to make a difference. One of the big changes we made from the previous edition of the rules was that protection values before were a static number. If I've done 3 damage to you and your protection is 2, you only take 1 damage. And we changed that to make protection values a roll instead. So you've got the roll, your protection value to try and save. And it's a tiny little difference. And we ended up upping everyone's protection by a certain amount to make sure that on average, you end up with about the same amount of thing, but it means that even a lowly slave can take on sort of the biggest creature in the game and actually do damage to it, or have a chance of doing damage to it. And that's important because it means that no one's ever going to be stuck in a corner and just be like, "Oh, well, I physically can't win." That's not good. That's not fun.
Well, you know, one of the biggest things that's happened to me, Lewis, in the last year that I've been doing this Insider Insight and talking to people that are involved in making games is my understanding of perception has changed a lot. So I originally was a get as much RNG out of the game. I want player decisions to determine who's going to win, not rolls of the dice, flips of the cards. I am learning how important that variability can be to the success and love of the game. And I think what you just talked about is very interesting because it's a perfect example of where, so we added some variability, right? So before it was static, you knew what it was. You had a protection of 2, and that's what it was going to be. And when you went into a confrontation, you knew you were walking in with 2. Now you guys have added some randomness to that. But what has it done? It's opened things up. It's made things more epic, more exciting. It's allowed the smallest guy with the las gun to shoot the huge tyrannid monster, right? And have one of those epic type moments. So that's fascinating. Now, something, Lewis, when we were talking about movement before that I want to get back to, and you hinted at it, was some of the design challenges that you've encountered with Carnivale. So I'd like to hear a little bit more about that. So now that we understand what your goals are, what you're shooting for, what a great Carnivale game is in your mind, from a design perspective, what are some of the challenges that you guys have come across or are still dealing with?
So absolutely the biggest challenge was jumping when we started. And that, like I say, there is a reason why people don't have heights and jumping and falling in games very often, because it's so hard to make it right. We needed to make sure the jumping was useful, but not as sort of, it didn't average out as well as walking, but you can make sure that you can jump and it will go well. And if it doesn't go well, then you fall. And if you fall, then it does the amount of damage you expect it to. Just making sure that jumping worked. And it's a very strange thing. You think, you just do jumping. And the way the rules are now, you're like, well, yeah, that makes sense. That's an obvious way of doing it. But jumping went through probably 6 months worth of revisions to make it right.
I bet. And a big part. It's a big part of the game.
It's a huge part of the game. And it's making sure that it feels right. It feels epic, but also it's right for what you're doing. And it needs to be, you don't want to have anyone that can jump farther than they can walk every single time. But you want to make sure that you can make it across the distance. Everything needs to be like that. And it also needs to be not complicated. We end up going through several variations where if you jump this far, then you get this. And if you jump this far, then you get this. And if you fall this far, it's this. And we had a really annoying point where if you're jumping down from a building and you make it part way and then you start to fall, how much damage do you take? Do you take the difference in the height? And then you have to work out your trigonometry of if you've gone diagonally. And so we ended up saying, you know what, if you've jumped off a building and you don't make the distance, then you fall from the top of the building because that's what gravity is. That makes sense. But it took us a long time to get to a point where that was the way of doing it. So jumping in 3D space is extremely tricky to work out.
Well, and again, another example of what we're talking about, where that pull, right, of simple, not oversimplifying, because that indicates you went too far, but that simplification for the purpose of gameplay versus the simulation, right? And that pull back and forth. But if you've got the right overarching goal set and you stick to it, it can help guide you. So, Lewis, for somebody listening right now that says, you know what, I want to try this game out. What is kind of the best entry point? What's the best way to kind of get started?
So when we did the Kickstarter, one of the core reasons we did it, not just for relaunching the model range, but was to do a two-player starter deck. Carnival Valley had never had that. There's this big, thick rule book, but you had to digest that and then buy your models and buy your scenery and all that sort of stuff. And we all know that, like, buying a new game, particularly with buying scenery, and Carnival is not light on scenery. Like, we're not going to pretend that, oh, you don't need anything to play. Like, you do need scenery. That's part of the game. But we don't want it to be a barrier to entry.
Mm-hmm.
So the two-player starter set has two gangs in it. It has the Guild and the Rishar. The Guild are sort of, they're like the mob, but a bit worse, essentially.
Okay.
If you pay your tithes, then they'll probably leave you alone. But if not, then they're going to knock on your door in the middle of the night and say, look, you've got to come out and fight with us. And if you don't, then they're worse than the fish people they're going to be fighting against. the Rishar are these sort of Lovecraftian fish monsters who have come through the Rent in the Sky, which is our big sort of instigating incident within Carnivale. It's this sort of vast astral tear, which has opened portals to magic, and the Rishar are sort of sneaking through into it. You get two starter gangs in the two-player set. You get the full rule book, which, you've seen it. It's massive.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Yeah, it's and within that rule book, I mean, like 90% of it is background information. It's his story. Mm-hmm. And the actual rules are fairly straightforward and simple. It's sort of a dozen pages, and you've got everything you need. And then there's also all the scenery that you want as well in a two-player set. And that was something that we really, really pushed for with the Kickstarter, that we needed it to make sure that when you bought the box, you didn't then have to go and buy MDF scenery. I mean, do buy MDF scenery for listeners. Like, that pays my bills. That's great. But sure, you don't have to. You absolutely don't have to. The box comes with tiles for making your board. It's 9 1-foot by 1-foot tiles, and they're double-sided, so you get loads of variation with it. Loads of buildings that you can play on as well, different heights. So, we wanted to make sure that everything was in there. I think it's a great set. It's something that so many people, when they come up to us at shows, they say, oh, well, how do we get into it? So you say, this is the box. And they're like, oh, great. And I'm like, no, like, hold on to it for a second. They catch it. Go, oh, wow, this is heavy. And like, yeah.
No.
And it's something that not many other companies do.
No, it's impressive. And I think the only other company that's come close, and it's not even comparable, is what Steamforged did with the Guild Ball, with those kickoffs, which is one of the few times where it's like, no kidding, you can play. You can open this now and you can play. And it's the same thing as true of the starter set you're talking about, but really a whole new level because of the terrain that's involved there, which is great. And I think I like that decision because it's obvious how important the terrain is to the game. And it would be disingenuous to sell a starter set and not provide that terrain, because even as a war gamer, you may not have the terrain that's going to fit and make the game as fun as it could be. Another bold decision that seemed to went well. So for people that are listening, Lewis, that are already fans or those that might get into it, can we talk about kind of the future plans? There anything that's on the horizon we should think about?
Yeah, we our plans have already been scuppered this year, of course, as everyone's had.
Yeah.
So things are all over the place at the moment. But the thing that we're working on at the moment is our first campaign expansion book for Carnivale. It's called Blood on the Water. It's part written. I haven't finished my part yet, so that's on me.
Too busy being on stupid podcasts.
it's a full new campaign expansion. It's mostly story driven again, because we want to carry on the world of Carnivale. We don't want it to be a static thing. It at the moment, the rulebook, sort of, there's a timeline of events in the main rulebook which finishes January 1st, 1795. Blood on the Water will probably do all of 1795, and then maybe on a little bit longer. So we get quite a lot of information in there. We haven't released too much about it at the moment, but I'm sure. Well, no one's here to tell me off, so I can probably tell a bit more than usual. All the factions are represented in there, and there's a huge push for new miniatures in there as well. So at the moment, we've been releasing we're releasing things from the Kickstarter and additional models every now and again, sort of boost up sort of the boxes to make sure that the retail offerings are really, really good. But when we hit Blood on the Water, I think every single miniature in there for probably a year and a half afterwards is going to be brand new.
Wow.
And there's really, really cool stuff. There's lots of stuff in there that's going to go in directions that people really don't expect. We've got a really active Facebook community group, and a lot of people are like, yeah, we need more of these. And I'm like, no. What they're getting. But in addition to like the background stuff, there's new rules in there as well. And the new rules are something that, again, we've come across this new element that we added to the game, which is something that none of us knew was missing from the core book until we started playing it. And now, like, we're still early playtesting because we got those sort of rules sort of very much penned down just before COVID hit. And
yeah,
it's hard to playtest when you're all at home. But yeah, there's definitely stuff in there that after you start playing with it, you'll wonder how you were playing beforehand.
Interesting.
About those rules. And like I say, it's stuff that no one's thought about yet on any of our community groups. No one's talked to us about, but
you guys don't even know what you want. that's exciting.
We're doing loads of additional scenery rules. We've taken some of the suggestions from the community as well, with new stuff going in. There's been some really, really awesome stuff going on. I think one of the things I can like point out now that is almost certainly going to make it in there, we still got some revisions to do and things, so I can't say for certain exactly what's going to be in, but someone suggested a really nice mechanic that every now and again you'll make a gang and you'll be a couple of points over, called Ducats is the currency, so you either have to take out an entire character and just boost up with equipment, or just be like, well, I've got a few points over, is that all right? And no one likes doing that. This new mechanic that one of our fans thought up, that having sort of negative items, so you give someone an item, it's minus a few points, and it makes you a little bit worse.
Nice.
But it sort of balances things out. And that's a really, really cool one. And we've made, I think there's about 15 of them that we've written, which are all thematic within the world, things that might affect you, that they make sense within the story.
Oh, that's cool. And that, boy, that adds a ton of flexibility to your crew building at that point, which is a huge selling point. So for those of you listening that play Malifaux, there's a couple of things that I think you're going to get turned on by. I thought it was great that it's like Malifaux, every character matters. So every model is a full-fledged character that's not a rank and file type situation, which is something that I love about Malifaux. The other thing that I found very interesting, getting outside of the movement mechanics, which we've already talked about, is the scenarios. I thought that the different scenarios were very, very interesting, and it wasn't just your same win conditions over and over again, which those of you that listen, I talk about modern rule sets. That's one of the things that I require in a modern rule set, is I require a game to have variable win conditions, and I want to be able to play and win several different ways. It's why I love Malifaux. It's what I find very interesting about this game. So Lewis, we obviously will have links to TT Combat, to the website, and I will be sure to point out the 2-player starter set. Is there any other plugs or shout outs we need to get out there?
We've got a brand new store opened up recently. So this is a really weird thing that's happened. TT Combat is owned by a parent company, Troll Trader. A lot of people know Troll Trader from eBay and Troll Trader cards and all that sort of stuff. We've just opened our first retail store. In the middle of the pandemic. Yeah. But we were in talks with Jason from Warbor, used to be, whose shop shut down last year through to some unfortunate situation. And he's managing our store for us in Bromley,
wow,
in the UK. And that opened about a month ago. And they're doing fantastically. And one of the most amazing things is we're seeing people going in, picking up the game and posting things on their Facebook pages. Look, I've just picked up Carnival and I've painted all these models. I've just painted all this scenery. So to see all that stuff going on day after day is just amazing. So yeah, I'd love to plug them. So yeah, you can find out all the information. You can Google that stuff. It's nice and easy.
Yeah, and I'll link to it too.
Troll Trader in Bromley.
Very, very nice. Very nice. Well, Lewis, I really appreciate it, my friend. This is it took a little bit of time for us to kind of get connected and get things coordinated. And like I said, I really appreciate you sending that rule book. And I'll let you know if when I get my first game in, because I'm very fascinated by it. But for those of you that listened all the way to the end, I appreciate it. Take care.
Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Twitch so you don't miss the avalanche of content we create. Links are in the show notes. Be sure to check out our shop on thirdfloorwars.com for the latest in gaming apparel and gear. There you'll also find the latest information for the U.S. Faux Tour. Find out where you rank in your conference or even in the entire United States. Get those models built, painted, and ready so we can see you at the next U.S. Faux Tour Masters event. Please take a moment to write a review of this pod on your favorite platform. Rating and reviewing helps us find more listeners almost as cool as you are. Be sure to share this feed with all of your friends who love tabletop gaming. Thanks for listening.
Howdy folks, Craig here. Now if you love gadgets as much as we do, you're going to love the new Third Floor Wars gadget bundle from Schooner Labs. Branded with the logo of your favorite podcast, it comes with two measuring multi-tools, a compass stepper for those tight and important movements, along with a compact dashboard to track your turn, strat, and scheme scoring, along with your soul stones and pass tokens. It is the perfect bundle for anyone who plays Malifaux or just wants to look cool while doing it. The link is in the show notes. Check them out and help support your favorite gaming podcast. One of our listeners reached out to me and dropped a bunch of shit. One of my listeners reached out to me and said, "Hey, Craig." All right. Now, who did the art in this book, dude?
So many people. Which ones? Which bit of art?
I gotta tell you, I was knocked out by this book.
It's great, isn't it? Fantastic.
Yeah, I'm not gonna go into it too much because I want to do it on the show and talk about it because it's been a while since I have been wowed. And this is strictly just from a graphic design art perspective. It's gorgeous. So I just wanted to find out whether I need to be tooting your horn out of the gate or if it's a team. It sounds like it's a team.
I've got one piece of art in there, but I'm not telling you which because it's not okay. Great.
The case is the one I hate. Yeah, look, everything except page 49, dude. Who the hell drew that? All right, I'll bring us back.
It's completely different to Blood Bowl. Yeah. Sorry, one second. I'm getting low on battery.
Uh-oh, we got to plug
That's
in?
That's not good. I'm plugged in already.
Did it the power supply sometimes gets disconnected halfway?
Yeah, maybe I took it downstairs and then upstairs again. Sorry, Craig, bear with
me. That's all right, man.
Stop that in. That should hopefully be working. One moment. There we go. All fine.
You good? Okay.
Yeah, all good.
All right. So I'll kick us off again. Yeah. So the boss man says, "Hey, let's make that many of you have heard of." Now, in his 4 years of TT Combat, he worked I fucked that up. Hold on. All right. That was cool. That's the first. You're the first terrain guest I've had. So you've answered all kinds of questions for me. All right. Any big key things I want to make sure we cover in Rumble Slam?
Not really, to be honest. It's right. Such a simple game. And we'll go into a bit about why it was designed, I think, is probably one of the most interesting bits.
Okay, that's how I'll start it off, and we'll you'll teach me all about it. All right. All right. Probably won't go super long on it because we covered a lot in Rumble Slam as far as the process. So let's just make this a quick pitch on Drop Zone. And I'll probably start with now, is this one that was acquired or designed in house?
Yep, acquired as well. Rumble Slam is our only proper original game.
Got it. Okay.
Hey, are you still here? Look, the podcast is over. And you sat through all of the breaks and bloopers? Well, I mean, if you're here, you might as well run over to patreon.com and become a supporter. Don't forget to rate and review this podcast, too, while you're at it, on whatever platform you're listening to. I do appreciate you sticking around. Take care.